Happy Friday, everyone. This is Pam Stack, your host, and you're listening to Authors on the Air. I know that you've stuffed yourself silly with turkey, ham, roast beef, pork, whatever it is that is your food of choice for Thanksgiving. I hope you all had a great time, either a small group or a big group, and that you all have things to be thankful for. I certainly know I have. And one of the things I'm thankful for is that I get to speak to authors from all different walks of life who have had different experiences and who are published either by themselves or through small press or through traditional press. Tonight I'm going to speak with someone who has, we've had a friendship through Facebook. His name is William E. Wallace. We're going to talk about, my question to him was, does writing imitate life or does life imitate writing? Should be a fun conversation. So hang on just a few seconds and we're going to get going. And you're going to have a chance to ask questions. Here we go. Back to Authors on the Air, everyone. My guest tonight is William E. Wallace. He is a former investigative reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, and he covered politics and political corruption, organized crime, the police beat, but more than just the beat itself, he dug into the police department. He won a lot of awards from the Society of Professional Journalists and the San Francisco Press Club. He took an early retirement and decided to turn his knowledge of all those things into crime fiction. Some of it's very noir, some of it's very pulp, but all of it's very good. So it's my pleasure to welcome to Authors on the Air, William E. Wallace. Hi, William. Happy Thanksgiving.
Hi.
And welcome to Authors on the Air. Thank you for being here.
And same to you. Thank you.
Thank you. You're absolutely welcome. You know, we've been talking about doing this for a long time, and I'm glad this date was open. I have just such a bad luck every time I go out of town. You know, I almost sliced my finger off yesterday at my brother's house. So I thought I'm going to get some bubble wrap myself up, stay inside my apartment, and just talk on the radio. It's the safest thing I can do instead of going to the emergency room and having fingers stitched up. You know, I'm particularly glad that you're here because, like we were talking about before the show started, a lot of journalists turn their writing experience into books, into either fiction or nonfiction, but most likely it's in fiction. And I want to know, with the things that you were investigating as a journalist with San Francisco Chronicle, did you make a conscious decision that you, when you wrote books, you were going to write about the things that you had reported on?
Yeah, actually I had, and I think part of the reason was when you're a reporter, you're really stuck, well, at least used to be, you were really stuck with the facts. You had to comport yourself with reality, and things didn't turn out well a lot of times, and things didn't turn out the way you would have liked for them to have turned out. When I write fiction, I wanted to be able to write about the same sorts of things that I was writing about as a journalist, but I wanted to make them turn out the way I wanted them to turn out rather than the way reality just happened to, you know, break for me. So, yeah, I think that that's really one of the things that I had in mind.
So when you're writing fiction based on something that's happened in your past, you're really just manipulating the story to make it more interesting and to have the ending that you wanted it to have, correct?
Pretty much. Sometimes I make stuff up from whole cloth, and then I interpose little things into it that are based on my real life. Other times I write a story that's kind of pretty much inspired by something that happened to me directly. And I think that the two, then there are ones that I don't have any relationship to reality at all in them, and those are just the kind of fun things to write where I just make it up on the fly. But yeah, I think between the two, those are the two options that I'm looking for, is either injecting little bits of life to give it some verisimilitude, or else basing it on something, because I think there's some sort of a lesson there that is a bigger lesson than I was able to write about as a journalist.
The thing that I'm interested in at this particular time is the fact that the it's kind of a subgenre, and I hate that we've come down to that, and I blame Amazon on that, because you know, you go look at genres, instead of it just being fiction and nonfiction, you've got thrillers and mystery, and then like 20 types underneath it. You know, I mean, I guess it's good in a way, but so you're writing, instead of just straight crime fiction, like a police procedural or a thriller, you are writing some very specific, has some very specific characteristics of noir and pulp. And the way I noticed that first was because of your choice of covers for your books. Your books would be different than like Daniel Silva's books. And I know he's a thriller writer, and I've spoken to him. His books are very traditional covers. Yours denote or indicate that you are either writing pulp or noir. Is that true, or have I got that all wrong?
No, I think you're right on the money. I started out, I always considered myself to be more of a pulp writer. When I was a kid, yeah. I wrote, hand-wrote stories and then retyped them on a little manual typewriter and sent them off to people like Fantasy and Science Fiction and Astounding and If, and collected a whole bunch of rejection slips. But those were pulp magazines back in those days. This is back in the 50s, and I really have always considered myself that. My house was full of pulp. My parents read things like Official Detective, True Detective, and so on.
Yes.
The bookshelves were full of things like Tobacco Road and Last Exit to Brooklyn. And those are pulpy books. I mean, they're overdone in a way, but I always liked that style.
Interesting. When you were a journalist, which story? You don't have to name names or anything, but was there any one story that stuck out for you that you said, "I don't like how this ended. One of these days, I'm going to write about it," and then you did.
I can think of one specifically. This is included in the collection, Hangman's Dozen. It's a piece called Hideout Case. And it's about this fellow, a Nuestra Familia member, a Mexican gang banger from California, who is in federal penitentiary and ends up becoming a federal witness. And they ship him back to Detroit, give him a new identity, get him a job, and so on and so forth. But he's a fish out of water in Detroit because he doesn't know any Mexicans there. He doesn't know any guys that are like homeboys. And this is based on an actual story. The last time I saw this fellow, his real name was Art Serrato. But he had the same middle or nickname, Mosca, for fly, because he's a little guy. He's, short and very slightly tall and so on. But he's a stone killer. He's a psychotic killer who just happened to get a job with the gang as an assassin. And they sent him back to Detroit. The feds are supposedly looking out for him. They got him a job on this non-union metal fabrication plant doing body part panels, he got a fender stuck in the conveyor belt and practically electrocuted himself trying to get it out. They didn't shut it down first, so it, you know, it throws him across the room, and he's badly injured by it. I sent him to the hospital, and he's recovering from it and has this discussion with this FBI agent about, you know, boy, things are just not going very well for me back here in Detroit. And so the guy gives him some walking around money, which they did for, you know, witnesses, some cash, mm-hmm. so that he'd have some money to spend, and says, you've got to go back to California to testify against these two guys that have been indicted. So, you know, you're going to have to make a trip back to California. Relax, have some drinks, you know, go downtown, have some drinks, and so on and so forth. And on his way downtown, he got robbed and shot in the thigh. And so this criminal became a criminal victim. And he told me about this, and I felt so sorry for the guy that I ended up loaning him $20 when we when we parted ways. But he was I always wanted to write that story, and I didn't even really change it very much. I just had him drop out of the witness protection program, say, I'm going back to California, and because at least there I know who's trying to kill me.
Happened in real life? Did he go back to California?
He did go back. He did go back, and the thing was, he didn't know who was trying to kill him, because there was the Nuestra Familia, which was his old gang, wanted to kill him for mm-hmm. snitching.
Sure.
The Mexican Mafia, which is their rival group, wanted to kill him because he was a member of a rival gang. And then there was a group called the Nuestra Contadina, which had just, it was a splinter of the Nuestra Familia, and they had just been formed, and they were like making their bones by killing people that, you know, were considered to be enemies of the NF. So he didn't know who was trying to kill him in California, but I wanted to make it so, you know, that there was more of a sort of sonorance to the story.
Sure.
And that one I wrote that way. But that story is directly
inspired. It's interesting to me that you said that you gave him $20, but just prior to that you said he was a psychotic assassin. You know, so this guy was really obviously good at manipulation, and it's kind of not funny, ha-ha, but funny, ironic, that here this guy's trying to go straight in Detroit when he's used to being in California, and, you know, is feeling pretty sorry for himself after he's killed people. It's an interesting twist. It really is. And it's a very noir thing. And I remember pulp books with the magazine racks and on the spinning carousels, you know, in the five and dime and all. And I remember my mom would not let me read them. I couldn't read True Detective or any of those. She said, you're going to have to read something else. I read like all 110 Agatha Christie's in a row. You know, I'd take one a day and, you know, take an hour to read it. But no, she wouldn't let me read them. She thought that they would really poison my mind. So it wasn't until much later. And I remembered those books, you know, because I love crime fiction. So here's my question to you, because your real journalistic life kind of poured over into your writing life. So, you know, I was saying, does writing imitate life, and does life imitate writing? And so what do you think? Does it?
I think that fiction imitates life more than life imitates fiction. Let's put it this way. I have a lot of there are a lot of people in my stories that are killers, and they're killers mm-hmm. who don't think twice about doing it. It's another tool. A gun or a knife is another tool that they use to do their job. I consider mm-hmm. criminals to be blue-collar types. They're working class. They don't have any particular skills that are saleable, although some mm-hmm. of them are quite good at committing crimes. But they really don't have any way of getting into the straight life, into the world of the Johns, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
That to me, it's more likely that I make a character like that up based on little bits and pieces of criminals I've known than it is that I'm going to go out and do something myself. This one story, Dead Heat with the Reaper, are two novellas. The first one's mm-hmm. called Legacy, and it's about an old guy who's dying. Turns out he's dying of liver cancer. And he's got some money that he didn't even realize he had, and he's trying to figure out what to do with it because he's only got a few months left to live. So, and that one, I more or less really borrowed that from my situation when I was diagnosed with cirrhosis, end-stage cirrhosis, because I knew that the end was coming for me. But he starts out the book by avenging his sister, who was killed by a couple of gunmen, who just happened to walk out of a convenience store when she was walking in. He avenges this sister by taking the pool cue that she gave him for a birthday present and beating them to death in a bar. Well, I'm not going to do that. I mean, you know,
right.
I'm not gonna turn
right.
around and kill somebody because it seems like it would be called for in a sort of a overall global justice kind of thing because
right.
that's
right.
just not the kind of person that I am. But I can imagine
right.
it happening. So
right.
I think that it's more like the fiction imitates life to a certain extent, but life does not.
Right.
I've never tried to remake myself as one of these criminals or anything. Because
right.
they get caught.
right. Well, that's the whole thing. No one ever said they were rocket scientists. So,
right.
you know, there is a reason they're criminals and they're not, you know, white collar. And wealthy and all. So, but we do understand that criminal enterprise at times is a money-making venture, obviously, but not for the average guy. William, you have been unbelievably honest about your own illness and your battle with liver cancer. I know that you're doing well these days. You're not cured. You're not accepting any treatment, if I'm correct in that, or you did and stopped. Has that changed your perspective on writing? Does it make you want to write more? Do you want to write? Are you trying to write differently or better? Or, you know, how does it affect you as a writer?
Well, first of all, let me correct you. It's not like I haven't accepted treatment. I'm taking a drug that is
okay.
intended to keep my blood vessels from growing so rapidly
okay.
because my particular type of sarcoma is blood carried, and I can't get treatment like surgical treatment because first of all the doctors are afraid to get into me because if they start cutting and it starts bleeding, then it could end
right.
up spreading a bunch of the disease further, and it's going fast
into
enough.
Your system.
I mean, it's about
sure.
It's about a millimeter every 4 or 5 months or so. So it's a matter of time when it's going to happen. But there just isn't really anything that can be done about it. I got caught way after the chances of having radiation therapy or any of that sort of stuff
sure.
Was out there, and there isn't any alternative treatment for it like some of these things that are being tried on a more or less experimental basis. It's all for other
mm-hmm.
types of cancers, not for
of
this
cancer,
type
right.
So,
right. But you have still continued to write even though you've known about this, and you're still putting out books. As a matter of fact, you just have a new one that came out, right? A new book
yeah,
that
Face
you put
Value.
Out. Face Value. So, but let me go back to my original question and ask you, How has knowing what your health situation is and knowing that you're not going to get treatment, that, you know, we all have a finite amount of time, how has that affected your writing?
Well, it's just made me more aware of it. It's affected my writing to the extent that I feel more determined to finish a bunch of projects that I've got open right now before I kick the bucket. I'm sort of bending all my efforts to do that at this point. I have a blog that I blogged other people's books and stuff. But I'm discontinuing it because I need more time to write the things that I've actually got that are open projects for me. And
right.
I'm trying to avoid spending as much time on the social media like Facebook because it ends
the
up burning
suck.
Up. Oh, I'm sorry?
Yeah,
yeah, it does. It's
a time suck.
It's a black
yeah,
hole.
It's hard to crawl out of.
So.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
It's a hard thing to crawl out of. You know, you get sucked in there and that's it. You really have to just not go in there at all, you know, in order to get stuff done during the day. That's all there is to it. So
yeah, so I get up in the morning and I turn off, I turn the computer on and I go directly to my Word files and I don't even bother to look on, you know, I might look at my email just to see if I got anything that was important. But otherwise, I just shut down the browser and just work on the writing. And I only go to the browser again when I've got something that I'm trying to research. I had a devil of a time. It wasn't a devil of a time. It's really enjoyable. But looking up the silencers that were available for a 92 FS Beretta semi-automatic pistol for a story I'm working on. But that kind of stuff I find fascinating. And I could once again, it's another sinkhole that you fall into. And you know, it's like down the rabbit hole, my wife says. You get in there, and then it leads you to another link, and it leads you to another link, and pretty soon you've read everything there is to know about this subject.
And that and other things, right? So it's not really a silencer. It's a sound suppressor, right? It's not truly a silencer.
Right. The slang term is can. And if you got a can, you can actually make them pretty darned quiet by putting a lubricant inside the tube and shaking it back and forth so that it actually gets the inside oiled, because it tends to help dampen the sound more. The bullet goes through faster and it makes the sound less obnoxious. But you know, they're not a silencer because they sound like you're slamming a screen door or something. It's it makes noise, but it makes less noise if you're going to kill a bunch of people in a meeting. It makes less noise than if you did it with, an open semi-automatic pistol that didn't have any kind of sound suppressor on it at all.
Speaking of research, how much research do you do for each of your books? Because sometimes your books are novella length, other times you have full-length books, and And it seems to me, if you're writing from your experience as a journalist and you're manipulating the way you want the story to go, you know a lot of the facts already. You're putting it into fiction story form. So how much research do you do compared to someone who's never been a journalist and having had characters like the guy from Detroit and everything?
That's a good question because, I as a journalist, I never felt like I actually mastered any of the subjects that I was writing about. The idea is you come in, you plug in at like 9 in the morning, and you spend the rest of the day until 5 o'clock doing one story after another. If you're just on a regular daily basis, if you're turning dailies for what's called the Metro Desk, then you're just kind of grinding them out one right after another. And that means that you're making a few calls on each story. You do a little bit of research in the clips or looking on the internet or something like that. But most of what you've got, you're getting from interviews and things like that. Investigative work is different because it's really record intensive. I used to spend hours and hours going through lawsuits. We did a police brutality thing the last 3 years that I was at the Chronicle, and I went through 245 lawsuits against the San Francisco Police Department that in which somebody alleged that a cop had beat them up for no good reason. And then that was on top of going through 8,000 records of what they call use of force reports, which are handwritten. San Francisco is like totally behind the times in this stuff. These were handwritten things that are done at the end of a shift by a cop who's involved in the use of force, and they're not particularly complete, but they're supposed to be accurate to the extent they can be.
Right.
And so I computerized those. I built an Access database with Microsoft Access software, and we ran them for patterns of violence by officers.
Wow.
And, you know, a lot of it was really fascinating stuff, and I don't think anybody's ever done anything like it. In fact, the San Francisco Police Department still does not have computerized records of these reports. And they're
that's
part of the reason.
Oh, that's sad.
It's part of the reason
they don't
why
want that, though, do they? They don't want the record.
I don't think so.
Records.
I don't think so. But that's an hour all by itself. I could give you chapter and verse. But that type of record research, I was the record rat. I was the guy at the Chronicle who, if they needed somebody to go and dig up a bunch of stuff, I was the one they sent out because I was the one that had to go and find witnesses and stuff like that when I was working as a paralegal legal investigator. I worked with that kind of data when I was in doing intelligence stuff in the Navy. So, you know, it's always been a part. I was fascinated by it, and I don't mind getting my hands dirty in the basement of a courthouse looking up, you know, hundreds of records. Other reporters don't like that. They find it's annoying. It causes
them to sneeze.
Tedious
job, too, I would imagine. Yeah.
it causes them to sneeze because all these records get dusty after a little while.
Dusty.
In the
dirty
basement.
And all that. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So it was just one of the things that I did. I gave classes in it at the Chronicle, in fact. The reason why I stopped doing it as a college instructor was because I suddenly realized the kids knew more about how to get information out of the computers than I had ever forgot. They'd forgotten more than I knew.
Wow.
So I thought, I'm not doing them any good. Why am I here? I'm taking money under false pretenses, supposedly teaching them something, and frankly, they know pretty much everything of importance that I know.
Right.
So
I
moved on from
that. You taught at UCal Berkeley, right?
Yes, I did, and I also that was for only one semester, though. There was a community-based newspaper called Mission Local that the University of California's graduate journalism department published. And there were two other papers that were also covering different communities, but they were both published. The work was all done on campus. This one was actually out in the Mission District. So, I mean, you know, you walk by and see the vatos and stuff like that standing on the street corner and people drinking 40s and stuff on your way to work. I mean, a bunch of hookers always were standing outside in this one cross street where we were at. So it was more like a real life experience of being in a news gathering organization where you had to sort of like take your courage in your hands and go out and walk the mean streets and things like that, as opposed to sitting in a classroom and using the telephone to nail stuff down.
Hold that thought just for a second. I want to remind everyone that this is a copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. I am speaking to former journalist and noir and pulp fiction author William E. Wallace. We'd love to take your calls. I'm going to give you the phone number, which is 347-633-9609. If you want to ask questions of William, please feel free to call in. William, I want to talk about your book, Face Value, because I love this story. I didn't know what wet money was. I had to go and do some research myself. Even though you have a small explanation for it, please tell me about this. Tell everybody about this book and where this idea came from.
Well, this was one I was just kind of tripping myself. I've always liked stories about criminals that were from the criminal's point of view. And like I said before, I try to write about them like they're lunch pail guys. They go to work in the morning. The lunch pail just happens to carry a .45 caliber pistol. You know, it's different. Well, this my guy Eddie Pax, I originally wrote about him in, he makes an appearance in something called The Custodian, which, speaking of borrowing a lot of stuff from life, there's a morning calendar call in that in court that sounds remarkably like the morning calendar sound when they're discussing a case and what they're going to do with it, because the defendant is in custody, but he's in the hospital or whatever. So this Eddie makes an appearance at the very end of that, because it involves money that was stolen from organized crime. In this case, I think it was like money that was from prostitution operations run by the Russian mafia in California. And in Pax, his company, called the Combine, goes to collect the money. And then he makes another appearance in something called Recovery Man, which is a real shorty. I think that was for Shotgun Honey or something. It was like less than 1,000 words. And he makes an appearance in that one. But the thing is that he settles the account. He gets them to either give back the money, or he recovers the money, or he gets them to sign over property that the value, a comparable value. And then he kills
the collateral.
Then he kills the people who did it, because you can't have these guys ripping off this big group that basically is what I call startup money for organized crime. They provide all this, the cash. You know, it's got to start someplace. When somebody comes up with an idea, they've got to start someplace with by raising funds. You can't run like a big store.
Got to collateralize it. Absolutely.
Exactly.
Sure.
You can't run a big store scam without having a big store. Yeah. I'm talking about the big stores like the movie The Sting.
Right. Sure. Sure.
And you have to have an office. You have to have this suits for the guys. You got to get a whole crew together so they can each play a role and so on. So anyhow, these guys are the ones that front the cash, and Eddie Pax works for them. And it's just another job, but he's a guy who has something missing in his brain when it comes to empathy. So when he gets sent out by his boss, Frank Chance, to recover some assets, he just, without even a second thought, at the end of the game, he kills the people who were responsible for taking it. And that way the balance is the books are completely balanced, and you know, everybody's happy except for the poor guy that got killed. And I was, the character was actually he was inspired by Parker, the heist artist that Don Westlake wrote about under the Richard Stark pen name. And he's a criminal, and he's ever concerned about is getting his share of the money. He doesn't want more. He just wants his share. And he has got the worst taste in picking crime partners that I've ever seen, because every time he does a job, they screw him somehow. So he ends up having to get revenge on all these people in order to make his money back.
Westlake was a really a magnificent writer when it came to stories that. I had a conversation the other night with Greg Barth, you know, who runs Noir on the Radio, about that. And other authors who've been on the show have mentioned him too, which is spectacular. I want to ask you about journalism nowadays. I have to tell you that I first went to school for journalism, and this is the God's honest, and I know you'll appreciate this. I remember saying to my mom and dad, 'cause I had a scholarship, and I remember saying, but I don't want to be a journalist because I don't get paid anything. So, and I had...
it's true.
One of my teachers was, you know, one of the teachers that we had, because I took a summer class, and he said, yeah, you don't get paid anything. It's, you know, you've got to really love writing. And he said, and there's no guarantee when you start off that you're going to be the guy coming up with all these great stories. You may be doing, you know, putting press releases in the paper, doing the daily calendar or something. And so I found that fascinating. You know, and so I stopped. I said, I'm not going to be a journalist. I like to write, but, you know, not fiction, obviously. You have a call. Let's see who's calling for you. In area code 970. Hi, you're live on the air. Who's this?
Hey, this is Eddie Cook.
Hey, Ed, how are you doing? Good.
Yeah, great.
All right, go ahead. You've got William on.
Real quick, I just wanted to say that William is on my short list of the real deal crime writers with Joe Lonsdale, Les Edgerton, Andrew Vox. Put him with Andrew Vox.
Thanks, man. That's great company to be in, I'll tell you.
But it's true. You know, don't you think, Ed, from William's experience doing these investigative pieces, not the fluff journalism, but investigative pieces, I mean, he has a little something-something extra that he's able to put that, translate that into fiction. Don't you agree?
Yeah, he's not just some sad ass in his mom's basement and his boxers making shit up. You know, he's the real deal.
Exactly. You called in. You talked to Joe Lonsdale when he was on, didn't you? When he was on Tom's show.
I might have. He thrills me to death. Yeah.
He's a great guy. Great guy. And by the way, everyone, this is Ed. E.A. Cook, he's also a great writer, too. And you've got to come on, Ed. You and I have got to make a time together to come on, you know, and chat about your books, too. I never know when to catch you. Are you working at night or are you working during the day? So you'll have to send me a message and let me know, okay? Because I don't know what your schedule is. It's kind of off the wall.
I work nights.
That's what I thought. So we'll have to do a daytime show, which is fine with me, but you'll have to get in touch with me, okay? And let's set something up and make sure you get on, okay?
Yeah, absolutely. But thank you so much for having William on there.
It's a great honor. You know, this is William and I have been talking about this for a while, and then, you know, I had to take a little bit of time out from the radio, and so when I first got back on again, I said, okay, come on. You and I are going to pick a time. And, you know, I was hopeful that it's because I knew I'd be back in town tonight. And it just worked out really well. So, you know, he's really fascinating. I'm so glad I did this. And he's going to come back. I promise you that, Ed. Okay?
All right. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Ed.
Thanks, Ed. Have a great evening.
You
too.
Thank you.
So, you know, my question to you, what I wanted to ask you, William, was that the crop of journalists today, or people who call themselves journalists, is very different. I grew up in Miami, so our paper was Miami News when it was still around, and the Miami Herald. The Miami Herald has switched back so many damn publishers that I never know which way it's leaning, but I also have noticed over the years, and, you know, I've been reading the paper for a lot of years, that it is more fluffy than it is factual.
That's industry-wide. It's happening every place.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the New York Times. It has become a lot puffier than it used to be. It's got a lot more service pieces and you know, they may not be the same sort of celebrities as you see in People or Us, but it's the same kind of, you know, sort of
no-fault reporting. Yes. Yeah, I don't see a lot of truly investigative stuff. I feel like someone's phoning it in and, you know, the person who has the byline is just taking something off a tick sheet and writing it versus that person who has been out in the field and is doing the dirty work the way you were talking to, looking through files, going and talking to leads, going to crime scenes, going and talking to witnesses. I don't know, you know. Even some of the Pulitzer winners, I'm convinced that it's a group of people anymore these days. It's not one person who's turning in an honest-to-God investigative piece. In the same way, television's even worse. You know,
well,
it's,
yeah,
because
television,
it's all about it's opinion.
What they do on TV is they read what was in the newspaper. And, I mean, you really see it in your local broadcast because, and it's absolutely, it's like super transparent if you listen to radio news. Radio news is like rip and read. They just take the daily paper and they read the stories out of it. And then when the editions change or the Tribune. They start reading the Tribune, and then they'll read the Santa Rosa Press Democrat, if necessary. But they don't do a lot of reporting themselves, and I think part of the reason is they don't have any personnel. And it's the same thing with newspapers anymore. When you're one of these young J school graduates that comes out and gets a job at a Metro Daily like the Chronicle, you are kept running literally from the time you come in the morning until you go home at night, redoing stories, rewriting press releases, doing what I call three call stories. You look at the press release and then you call three people, and then you put their
quotes in
someplace.
And that's your confirmation, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And that's it. And you spend all your time doing that, and you don't have time to really dig into a subject. It's getting harder and harder for somebody that's an investigator to do it. Also, it's very expensive. This is one of the most cash intensive parts of journalism, and that police brutality thing. We had people working on that. They weren't working exclusively, like they'd pull us off to do other things. But there was Susan Sward, Elizabeth Fernandez, Seth Rosenfeld, and me, four reporters, pretty much most of the time working on stories for that series. And a couple of different photographers cycled in and worked with us pretty much exclusively on those stories. And it took us 3 years to do it. I mean, you know, you can't take four reporters out of circulation for 3 years and still publish a newspaper.
Well, and therein lies the rub, because people are actually reading paper less. They want to get their cycle, their recycled news someplace else where it's quick and dirty. And they don't want to get all the facts of the case. They just say, okay, this is what happened. You know, if it bleeds, it leads. So you go ahead and you say, this is what happened, and this is the end of it. And the part in between doesn't hold any interest for people anymore, where to me that's the most interesting part of a really good investigative story. I know that if you're going to write that type of story, if you are truly going to be that kind of journalist, you have to go to a magazine that's willing
Absolutely.
To invest time, because it's not going to be on television, no matter how many part series they're going to do. It's too Hollywoodish, even if it's supposed to be straight news. So I understand. A lot has changed, and it breaks my heart because I love newspapers. But, you know, anymore these days, you pick up a paper that used to be nice and thick on a Sunday, and you'd have all these different great sections, and now you have advertising, and people are not buying the paper anymore. It's a sad thing. I wish that we had more time to talk. I've taken up so much of your time already. Will you come back and talk to me again?
Sure, love
to. And let's talk more about this. And you know, I'd love to get someone like Ed Cook to come on, and maybe a couple other people, maybe get Joe Lansdale on, and, you know, have a good conversation about this kind of writing and journalism and all. I think it's important because a lot of newer people who are coming into pulp and noir don't know where a lot of this stuff comes from. So let's do this again.
Yeah, it was an eye-opener to me. My first Left Coast Crime Conference, and I happened to be attending. I wasn't a member of, but I was attending a panel that had Dale Barry and Gary Phillips and, I can't remember who the other person was. There were three basic guys, and all of them knew all of this stuff about pulp.
Yeah.
You know, they knew about
the
fact that romance stories were once a part of the pulp market.
Pulp,
that,
right.
You know, and that there were a lot of women that really cut their spurs on editing stuff like Black Mask and so on. And I was, this is great.
That turned into gothic romance. So
Will
Bahara is a real good one to talk about that. You know, he's the pulp king as far as I'm concerned. He's so into it, and it's very interesting to me. So we're out of time. Otherwise, I would continue this conversation because it's so fascinating to me. Happy holidays. You and I will be talking during that time anyway, but please come back, will you?
Will do.
I would love to have you
back.
Thank
you very much for having me.
It's really, truly been a pleasure. I want to remind everyone, tomorrow night is Ask the Author. At 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 o'clock Pacific, the show goes live. I have one writing question for all you authors out there. One question. If you've never been on the radio, or even if you have, you call in, you're going to give me your name, you're going to tell us what genre you write in and where you are on the web so people can find you, and then I'm going to ask you one question. That's it. It's going to be fun. So, and the lines will be open. We can handle up to 50 callers at a time. I expect to hear from authors out there and readers, too, if you have questions for your favorite authors. William, thank you so much, and you and I will be talking again. Have a wonderful holiday weekend, and same for everybody else. Thank you.
Right back at you.
Thank you, honey. Good night. And good night, folks.